Breathe in. Breathe out. Breathe in. Breathe out.
Breathe in.
Breathe out.
This is Psychoanalysis.
Hey, Psychoanalysis patrons. Welcome to our monthly bonus episode that's up for all patrons. This month, we're going to share our thoughts on the latest Netflix offering from Mr. Mike Flanagan, the 7-episode limited series Midnight Mass. We are your hosts, Mike Snoonian.
And I'm Jen Adams. I forgot I was going to say my name.
And I'm Honor Stahl, Lara.
You. The Leonard Stahl, Carla. You. Sorry.
Kamal Lama.
Oh my God. I think Jen forgot her name. I think that's what happened there.
Yeah. When I am not reading the outline, there is just no telling what I'm going to say.
It's been a day. That's okay.
We're recording this late on a week on a school night, so like yes. We are all a little frazzled.
And it's been a week. I'll let listeners know. Like I got in from Telluride like a day and a half ago at 2 a.m. I walked in to a daughter that has been diagnosed with COVID, which is awesome. Aww. Although she seems to have already recovered from it. Like a shit storm at work, basically. Like work has turned into slap fights with the kids. So I get to deal with that. And I'm stuffy. But basically not British stuffy, but like my nose is stuffy right now.
What's British stuffy?
Like, you know, like you wear a monocle.
I see the commoners are gathering around the moat again. My word, I think we should execute them.
Let them eat cake off with their heads. Chip, chip.
This is where, like, we called my mother-in-law today to let her know that her daughter has COVID. And, like, when we talk about narcissism and personality disorders, like, textbook. Do we take this? That's just for the patrons. Screw it.
You're like, you can leave it in. You can edit it out.
I'm trying to make dinner for the fam, and my wife tells her mom about this. Which, you know, even though my daughter's all right, still, it's COVID. Pretty serious, you would think.
We reacted with gravity, I think.
With intensity. Mm-hmm. My neighbor Jan is planning this vacation and blah, blah, like, and I'm like, are you fucking kidding me? I pulled a, like, we're having dinner now. It's time to get off the thing. And I'm just like, I was angry. But anyway, textbook personality disorder. Anyway, not to diagnose from overseas, but here we go. So, Lara, do you want to talk me off the ledge? And we are going to give you...
Oh, yeah, this show's a pick-me-up, by the way.
This is a...
Let's get into the much more cheerful conversation about Midnight Mass. A show about a bunch of families that get along real well and have no problems. Yes.
And religion is a source of strength and comfort
community, togetherness, and all
excellence.
That.
So before we get to our thoughts on the series, we are going to do a brief synopsis of Midnight Mass. We're going to assume that you've watched the show, so be forewarned, we are going to be spoiling it throughout from this point forward. Lara, how would you feel about reading the synopsis?
Just fine. Not bad.
Not good. Just in the middle. Just fine.
Okay, here we go. The small community of Crockett Island, off the coast of Maine, awaits the return of their beloved priest, Monsignor Pruitt. In place of this aging priest arrives the young Father Paul Hill, along with the return of 2 former inhabitants of the island. Riley Flynn returns to Crockett after 4 years incarcerated for killing a young woman in a drunk driving accident. Also making their return is Erin Green. She escaped the island and her abusive mother, but has returned many years later, alone and pregnant. The new priest's arrival coincides with a number of, for lack of a better word, miracles. Some are small, like a person no longer needing glasses to see, or various aches and injuries disappearing overnight. Others are far more miraculous, such as a paralyzed young woman suddenly being able to walk, or a devout Catholic woman with Alzheimer's regaining clarity in her thinking, and even aging in reverse. Still, these miracles come with a cost. Devout to the point of martyrdom, parishioner Bev Keen bends the priest's ear, exhorting him to do more. Exhorting him to do more in the name of God. She's a real bitch. Okay, sorry.
She is the worst.
Yes, she is.
She sucks. Great performance. Father Paul isn't without his own secrets, such as his true identity. The presence of a leather-winged angel, so-called angel, he has kept hidden on the island, or his mysterious illness that can only be abated with the consumption of blood. Live blood! Okay, I just wanted to get a little...
Oh no, I love
1970s
it.
Trailer reader with it. As great. Sickness and madness take hold of the priest, Bev Keen convinces him to do horrible acts in God's name. Finally, amounting to the shocking finale, where the walls of the hallowed church and the soil of the island itself run slick with blood.
This is, I'm looking at my writing and I'm like, my God, I should not write on my phone. Like, it's never.
No, great. I thank you for writing the synopsis, and it gave me lots of purple prose that I got to just do that with. So, at the end of the day, I wasn't sure how I felt going in, but I enjoyed that.
Excellent. Yeah. We will find the funny where we don't know that it was before. So before we dive into like the themes of Midnight Mass, let's take, and this is kind of like an in-between regular episode and comfort horror episode, I would say. It kind of like sits in that nice little middle ground here. Before we dive into the themes of Midnight Mass, let's take a moment to talk about our own feelings or overall impressions of the series as a whole. Jen, I know you've got like a lot of thoughts on this series. So why don't you go ahead and start us off?
Yes, I have so many thoughts on this. I loved it. I love Mike Flanagan in general. I have been known to call myself a Flanistan, even though that's super cheesy. I don't care. But yeah, I love him. I think he, like I said, he speaks my like cinematic emotional language, you know? And I think that just we have similar life experiences and similar taste in horror that I think I just happen to really align with most of what he does. And I just love him. The only thing that I've seen him do that I didn't like was Before I Wake. And I didn't think it was bad. It just was not for me. But everything else, absolutely everything else, I've loved. And I've written a ton about him. In fact, I even started one piece a while ago with Mike Flanagan, Stop Reading My Diary, because I was like, why do you keep talking about personal things from my life and making me cry about them? And this show was just right up that alley. There are some very, very personal things that hit really, really close to home for me in this, in a way that I found really cathartic and really enjoyable. But I don't know if that's the word, but like I felt they were well done. I loved it. I loved the ending. The fourth episode, like there was in the fourth episode when Erin was giving her monologue, and I'll have thoughts about this later, but like I had to stop it and cry. And I was like, almost like scream crying. Like it was just such a like really, really visceral release of emotion that I really enjoyed. And it was, I mean, it just really got to me. And then in the last 10 minutes, I was watching it and I was crying. And I was watching it by myself, and Corey walked in the room, and I swear it was like that scene from Knocked Up when he walks in and she's delivered and she just yells, "Get out!" And I screamed at him because I was like, "You're ruining my moment." But yeah, I loved this. The themes of religion, the themes of like, there's a lot of addiction themes in AA and recovery, and just kind of what we interpret God to be and making sense of the universe, just things that I've been really thinking about a lot in the past few years that are really aligned with like my journey with Stephen King's works also. And yeah, I love, like, it is schmaltzy, but I feel like sometimes I want something that will let me say the really deep emotional feelings that sometimes I feel like I'm too cynical to let myself go to. Mm-hmm. And that's what I really enjoyed. And also it was fucking scary. So
yeah.
Yep. So those are my feelings.
How about yourself, Lara?
Just handshaking and fist bumping with Jen here, as we seem to be on the same page. It fucked me up. Like, fucked me up. There was a lot of things in here. Maybe and there's so much packed in here with all this, since it's such an ensemble cast and you get such a variety of life experience and the stories of the characters. So there was a lot in here that I also found hit very close to home for me. I was sobbing so hard during the last episode. By the end, I was like choking on phlegm because I was watching it in bed with my laptop and I was just like, and it was just like, it was, you know, it's sometimes it's good that I live alone. My dog is just looking at me like, Jesus Christ.
If only there would have been like a live feed of both of us watching this thing.
Just like,
I just watch it with a heart of stone. Arms folded, stoic face.
Well, you know, we all have our buttons, and this That's pushed true. Ours. You know, it starts off so scary and weird. At first, I didn't really love the vampire twist because I kind of went in blind. I didn't know what to expect, but I do think it ended up fulfilling the promise of the themes it set up in the first few episodes. So, because at first, when it was like, oh, it's just vampires, it's just like we're going to be watching Salem's Lot for real, but it's not, you know, because there's a lot of inspiration there. Not necessarily in a bad way, though. It ended up doing its own thing, and I thought it had some amazing, amazing performances. I especially loved, I had to look up the actors' names, but I wanted to give them props. Samantha Soyane as the supremely evil Bev Keen, just great villain performance. And Rahul Kali as Sheriff Hassan. Dude just has such a kind and emotive face. Like, I want to see more stuff with that guy. I just like him a lot.
He's also super hot.
And he's like really fucking hot.
He's big part of the show iZombie, which was excellent.
You know, I watched a bunch of that years ago. Maybe that's why you looked familiar to me. Yeah. I like repressed most of it. Some of the writing does get a little maudlin, especially the monologues, but at the same time I loved like the one in the final episode because it synced up so well with my own experiences of both having loved ones pass on and facing the ineffable in ketamine therapy. I thought like it synced up so much with my own experiences that I went through with doing ketamine therapy that like I thought I was going crazy while I was watching it because I was just like it. And, you know, something that people who have gone through like psychedelic experiences or mystical experiences talk about is that it is almost impossible to discuss those experiences without sounding like a Hallmark card, without sounding cheesy, because the nature of true spiritual revelation, not religious revelation, but spiritual or like mystic, whatever you want to call it, revelation, it defies language. And it's something that is discussed extensively in the book by Michael Pollan, How to Change Your Mind, which is what got me down this rabbit hole and seeking out ketamine therapy. And I thought that that did about as good a job as you can capturing that, like on the brink of death and realizing the connectedness of humanity with like this greater collective unconscious. And I thought it was really beautiful. So it just like fucking destroyed my ass. Like my ass was ripped wide open. So Mike.
So if I'm not on the same page as the two of you, I'd say I'm in the same chapter. I remember like when I watched this over the course of three nights, and I think those first two nights I kept texting Jen and Lara like my impressions of it, and I'm like, oh shit, like this is really fucking good. It hit on like in terms of its take on spirituality and the place of organized religion and community, it hit on a lot of the themes that I toss over in my head a lot. I thought that the kind of back and forth between Riley and
Monsignor Pruitt.
Monsignor Pruitt, yeah. Mm-hmm. I thought where, you know, basically Riley was saying it's very difficult to believe in a God that allows so much inhumanity to take place when if he's all knowing, all powerful, why do we let children suffer? Why do we have war? And yes, I know there's man's free will, but it does touch on things where it's like, why would someone create such an imperfect world? And it's something that I struggle with because I'm someone that grew up in a very Catholic family. Like I was an altar boy for a number of years, and one of the priests pedophiles. I luckily was not affected by that personally. Mm-hmm. Like I just got a vibe from him when he came on board and was out within a few weeks. Yeah. even at a really young age. But that's neither here nor there. But like, I grew up with religion and really never questioning my faith until, ironically enough, seeing Saving Private Ryan and the opening scene where they storm the beach at Normandy, and there's so much death. So, and it's just so quick. I'm like, how can there be a God that would allow this to happen? Like, it's actually the thing that made me, for the first time ever, question my faith. I think I've come to the understanding or the belief or faith that there is something greater than this world once we move on from it, but I don't know what it is. And I think that just religion is our own, it's so much larger than we can comprehend, that religion is our own feeble attempts at trying to comprehend it at best. At worst, it's just another means of control and trying to consolidate power over persons. But I found like the scenes with Riley gorgeous. And I found, like, again, that scene with Kate Siegel's Miss Green, when her and Riley describe like what happens to you when you die. I found that really moving and really beautiful, this idea of being reunited in some capacity with the persons that you love. I think that's a very comforting and wonderful thought, especially if you've experienced premature loss, which is a bit large theme in this. The other thing that really hit me, there's a moment, and I believe it's the last episode, where the mom, played by Kristen Lehman, she talks about how we're all persons of faith that believe when we die, we have eternal life and we have eternal paradise. Yet, even though we proclaim that, we actually cling to life with every scrap that we can. Why do we do that if we actually believe with all of our hearts that there's something better than this? Why do we cling to the last few moments of life, even if they're absolutely miserable? And that's something I actually struggle with a lot in my own faith. So I think the first five episodes really did it for me. And then the last two, ironically enough, when the horror kicks in, when it stops becoming a more philosophical show on religion and recovery and community, when it becomes less of that and more a standard horror movie or horror show, that's where it lost my interest a bit, even though it's really well done. I will say that the moments of horror are pretty fantastic. The ending didn't work for me. And I think because of the way that last episode played out, the ending goes for this kind of sweeping, epic, sentimental gesture with this like beautiful hymnal playing in the background. And because of everything that had preceded it in that episode or in the one before it, it felt false. It felt like Mike Flanagan, who kind of does this, he goes for that kind of sentimental ending that pulls at the heartstrings. I just didn't feel it had been earned, and it knocked things down a peg for me. And that's just me in my own estimation. If someone else found that it was really moving and beautiful, like mazel tov, like I have no issue with that whatsoever. But for me, I'm like that, those last 5 minutes felt pretty false. So they rung false for me.
There's like, I loved it because one, I love that hymn. It's just, and just like sure. The procession, it's gorgeous. So there are two parts of me. There's the part of me that just got really swept away by the ending and just absolutely loved what it was doing to my heartstrings. But then the analytical side of me is like, I've got a couple of questions because I think the biggest issue I have is I feel like the terror of being a vampire is that you lose the afterlife. You know, you lose heaven because you're undead. And it reminds me of 30 Days of Night and the man whose father had, or his family had died in the car accident. And he was like, if I'm a vampire, I'm never going to be reunited with my family in heaven. And so I was thinking about that while I was watching this. And I was like, I feel like for a show that talks so much about the afterlife, that is the true horror of becoming a vampire for me, is that you lose access to that. So there's part of me, like the sentimental part that really cares about these characters is glad that it didn't play out that way. But I also can hear you about, like, I do feel like there's an element of feeling like a little like there was a little bit of a cop out, and I hesitate to say that because I did really enjoy the ending.
I think what it was, I don't mind how that ended. I don't mind that the choice they made at the end to basically immolate themselves. I think that was a fine choice. What rang false to me was like this beautiful hymn, because you're right, it's a gorgeous hymn, and this like sense of almost like duty, and this sense of like serene peace and beauty. I think that in and of it, and it was beautifully shot, because Flanagan again is just, he's just a wonderful director, and he just knows how to make things work. I think removed from the context of the previous hour and 50 minutes that we had seen, it would work, but like the choices that everybody made leading up to that were so horrific that that kind of redemption didn't really feel earned. And it didn't feel earned because they didn't really make a choice at the end.
Did they really make a choice while they were becoming vampires and given no guidance? You know, I feel, right. I mean, I'm just pushing back on this a little bit, because I think that was maybe the point a little sure. bit, was like that, like none of this is really a choice, and that also, but it is. And it, I just right. think it was showing, maybe not in a like super realistic way, but you had a little variety of choice in there with certain, you know, Riley's parents versus some of the others versus Bev Keane. There was like a spectrum versus, you know, and I think that sure it was represented in pretty broad strokes, but I thought it got, you know, sort of poetically got this message across of like, you know, and it is, to me, a lot of that was about, and a lot, one of the big themes, and I guess we're, you know, we are in the themes now, so let's just say that we're in the themes.
I would say like what landed for me was Riley's choice, and I think that will fall to the themes.
Yes, and that's what I was going to bring up, is, you know, one of the big themes was forgiving yourself for your mistakes and making true spiritual penance, and I think that Riley's character, especially contrasted with Father Pruitt sort of trying to rationalize unethical behaviors in the name of religion, Riley sort of like saw through all the bullshit, and it's sort of proof that spirituality can be completely divorced from religion, that you can be, you can make mistakes and you can then make, go on to make better choices. And it really isn't about asking for forgiveness from some higher power. It's about being able to forgive yourself and, you know, go to bed at night. And that if you haven't reached doing it for that reason, then you have, you know, missed the point. Like, I love when he slips Father Pruitt the note, like ashes to ashes, you know,
because I think ashes that we were born, to ashes we will return.
And, exactly. And it sets up like such a good moment before all the shit goes down, just thematically. I don't really have a hot take on, or like not even a hot take, like I don't really have a fully formed thought on how, I guess the ending didn't strike me as unearned in any way, or it didn't strike me as, it just struck me as like very Mike Flanagan, you know, like he's going to do the big sweeping, most emotional, gut punchy kind of thing. And the whole show was very like that to me. It was very like, let's talk about things and then let's show really big movements and big, you know, sweeping gestures and stuff like that. So that, you know, the end to me just felt like a nice little, you know, he does really like to tie things in a bow, even if it's not, you know, like a happy bow. He likes to fully resolve a thought or fully resolve the note of the hymn, which is ironic because it's like the hymn stops at the moment the sun rises and it's not resolved. You know, it's just there's silence.
Right.
I don't know.
I think that's why I like that this is a limited series, and why, you know, the House on Hill House and the House on Bly Manor, like they're not continuing stories. Like I would much rather have Mike Flanagan come out with a new series every year. They're unrelated than like, let's just continue something. So I do appreciate that this is a, and it, to me, it is the best adaptation of Salem's Lot that I think we're ever going to see. Like it really, it really is.
Yeah, it's the gritty reboot, or like
I texted Mike Rothman. I was like, it's Lady Salem's Lot, because there were so many female characters.
It definitely, to me, it has that feel. I love, you know, and to, what's funny is like, I don't think I appreciated Riley's character until he was gone. because I'll say for most of them, like, oh my God, this dude's such a mope. And it is kind of hard to spend a lot of time with him. And you understand why he is. I mean, it's not like he doesn't have a good reason to be. But I like that his character did his best to make the right choices, not because there was some reward at the end, but because they were the right choices to make. And I think that that's something I think the series does a tremendous job of saying, like, we shouldn't just make like the good choice because we're promised a reward at the end. And if you're into like Calvinism, there's this idea that everyone is predetermined where they're going to go when they die. So the idea is do as much good things as you can to kind of convince yourself you're going to the right place. To me, and obviously the idea with Catholicism and like tithing the church and like giving alms to the church, you know, is this idea that you're almost buying salvation in some sort of way, or that you can live a completely immoral life, but then ask for forgiveness at the end and be saved. But if you're not baptized or if you're not given over to God, then no matter how altruistic you are, then you're damned at that point. And that's just not the kind of spirituality I would ever want to believe in. So I really appreciated Riley's choice. Actually took me completely by surprise.
Me too.
And it's one of the rare moments that I didn't see any of that coming.
I only saw it coming when they got into the boat. I was like, up until that moment, I was like, but then I just sort of like the way that the dream and that, you know, because he kept saying in the dream, like, I'm turned toward the sun. And it was just so freaking beautiful. I think that this was just one of the most ambitious attempts to tackle big picture issues, big, hard to verbalize, hard to not make cheesy and lame and sound like, you know, freshman philosophy student, like, you know. And it definitely has those moments where it almost borders on some of that stuff, but he grounds it in these characters and this story that make me like forgive it for all of its cheesiness, or, you know, like it's just and I'll just say, one, I was the only Jew at a Catholic school for 8 years. But I sat through so many masses. So just this whole thing, I was like, you know, oh, it was like so triggering. Like, you're just hearing all those words. So I related to the sheriff character and his son a lot, you know, feeling like outsiders in this world. And then, I don't know, I feel like now I'm just thought dumping, but what really got me was like, it was the only thing I've seen that sort of captured some of the spiritual shit that I've been thinking about. It's like this idea of like the acceptance of death is so important to the renewal of the earth, like that we are, and that these are some of these ideas that you hear about in Catholicism that always kind of resonated with me when I was a kid, but then were just perverted by the institution of the church. Like, we are shepherds, like we are the shepherds of nature and we pass through it. But it's our responsibility to take care of it. And when our time is over, to put down our bows and go through the pasture ourselves. Like, we cannot control it. We can only shepherd it. And to me, this was like, I was watching, you know, I was like that meme from Tim and Eric of Eric Wareham going like mind blown, like, whoa. Because it's like, I thought this was such an excellent parable for our moment in time. It was so timely. For climate change, for denial of death and disease as it relates to COVID, for how humans behave in a crisis, like all these things came together, and how we make sense of chaos and how we make and how we use the chaos to rationalize who we really are inside. All of these are like the big themes that I've been like bashing my head against the wall. And I think a lot of us have, because we've been forced to slow down and be by ourselves and reflect on this shit. So I just thought it was one of the most timely shows, and like, whatever its flaws, like, fuck, man, like, who the hell else is out here trying to like tackle this shit and doing it as effectively as this? Like, I wish my dad had been around to see the show, because he was also like a lapsed Catholic, and I think he would have thought it was so beautiful. And it made me, I'm gonna trail off here.
Yeah. And Jen, I know that like you've had thoughts on the show with regards to the idea of a higher power in recovery. Like, are you comfortable kind of sharing those?
I am. Yeah. And I want to point listeners, if you haven't already, we did an episode on the Losers Club where me and Anna and Randall talked about recovery and Stephen King's work, where we talked about this a lot. But it is something that like I have a hard time that I've grappled with as far as kind of going to recovery meetings. I still sometimes trip over the word alcoholic, but I have spent some time in AA meetings. And one of the fundamental pieces of that is accepting powerlessness over a higher power. And I remember reading the first step and it was like, I accept that I am powerless. And I was like, fuck that. I'm not saying that shit. I'm not giving up power. And so that was a huge hurdle for me. And I still haven't worked any of the steps because of that. And I think a lot of times AA doesn't work for people because they have had bad experiences with religion, or they have a hard time. Like AA is very intentional about saying the God of my understanding, not God in quotation marks. And that is something that I've had to redefine how I understand a higher power. And one thing Anna said that she had heard from someone in one of her meetings is that a person she knew said it was not me, like not me in quotation marks. Like if I can admit that I am not the most powerful thing in the universe, then something else is more powerful than me. And so it is not me is the higher power. And that felt like an interesting way to access that. And I'm still kind of thinking about it, but like I watched Riley struggle with that. And I watched him think, how can I make sense of this? And how can I give up this power that I really, really want to have over my life? Because there's a lot of recovery that is like you having to take control over an addiction, and to give that control to something that you can't see is really scary. And so when I was thinking about the reason he is able to make that choice, because he is choosing not to drink something. And that is what fundamentally, like, that's why he makes that choice in the boat. And it's because he had already done that, because he saw what happened to his life when he let an uncontrollable need to drink take over. And I just thought that was really beautiful. I still have not seen an accurate representation of what a meeting feels like to me,
right?
Like the meetings I've been in, but that was very, very close, except there's usually more than two people.
Both of them
are usually alcoholics.
Right. And usually one of them is not a vampire.
Yeah.
Just putting that, you know.
I wanted to ask what you made of Riley basically he accepts the meetings once Joe becomes part of it, because then it's not about just like Riley is not just going to those meetings for himself any longer, but he recognizes like how valuable those meetings are for Joe. So he kind of wills himself to go just so he can pull for this person. And how how you felt like that was represented, or is that even an accurate?
Oh, I definitely think it is. There's a whole, and we could say the same thing about Aaron too, because I think Aaron and Riley are both in later stages of their recovery. They're not in those first few days, and everybody who stops drinking has had the first day that they didn't drink, and then the second day that they didn't drink. And then, you know, I don't know if you've gone to meetings, but you've gotten your one day chip, you know, and that's, and one of the things that you do is, and this was really uncomfortable for me at first, but you go, and if there's a new person to a meeting, you just pass a paper around and you all write your phone numbers down and then you hand it to the person. And if it's like a woman, then you pass. I know.
And I just made that woman, like, I'd be like, no. No.
No. And I will say I have never been called by anybody whose number, but I had that experience too. I was like, I don't know these people, but there is this sense of, like, we know how hard that day is, and we know you want that person to get through it. And it's also, it's something else to focus on. Like you can really beat yourself up and feel like shit for being an alcoholic, like really easily. It's really easy to punish yourself. And so if you can take the focus away from yourself and focus on kind of helping somebody else, then, you know, and that's what sponsors are. Sponsors aren't like magic people that have gone through, like gotten advanced degrees. They're just people that are further along in the program than you are, you know? So I did really enjoy that.
And I just do want to point out, and I think Riley points it out too at some point, and I don't know the name of what he brings up, but that there are alternatives to AA for people who are uncomfortable with the God or higher power spirituality aspect to it. And, you know, just Googling alternatives to AA, I immediately found an article on Vox talking about studies showing how many can be equally as effective. You know, obviously I have not looked into this at all besides just clicking on this while we were talking, but I just kind of wanted to like fact check myself a little bit there. That, you know, there are alternatives out there. So if anyone who's listening is struggling, well, Google alternatives to AA, or we can perhaps round up some, you know, that don't necessarily have to involve the spirituality.
Yeah. I don't currently go to meetings, and I might go back one day, but the most important thing is that you don't drink, and within reason, whatever gets you there is wonderful for you, you know, and it doesn't matter if it works for anybody else.
I want to talk about Father Pruitt or Father Paul and his character, because I think like it's Hamish Linklater's performance is pretty incredible. I will say, as someone that spent the early to mid 90s doing a lot of slam poetry in different clubs, that like, you know, one of my friends texted like, anything can sound like a slam poem if you so you get a lot of that, like there are a lot of monologues in this show. Like it's very monologue.
I feel like I'm watching heavy. So I Married an Axe Murderer, so.
Right. But what I found really moving about, and I found myself rooting for his character throughout a lot of it, like knowing that some of the choices that he were making were not necessarily the best choice, but it felt like they were coming from a place of real passion and like real faith. And it reminded me a lot of like Jesus in the garden and the story before the crucifixion of like Jesus asking, do I have to bear this burden multiple times before he finally accepted, you know, his fate to be crucified, like knowing what was going to happen to him. You know, I think we forget that Jesus was human and fallible and carried the same sort of emotions that all of us have. And I'm sure in that moment he was very fearful. And to me, Father Paul saying like, this is my burden and is it the right thing? And I found myself, despite his actions, mostly rooting for him.
Oh yeah.
The speech he gives, or the homily he gives in episode 6 before the shit really goes down, where he talks about the reason he's doing this is because they want to be like the army of God, or like the God's right arm at that point. That was a bit of a turning point for me, but I also found it fascinating. This idea that like we have this ability to be real soldiers for God, despite the actions we're going to take seeming very evil. And this idea that like of turning the whole community into vampires and then essentially overrunning the world. Like if they were to get off the island and onto the mainland, you could see it's kind of like we just did the thing for a comfort horror episode.
Yeah.
The idea of how fast that could actually spread at that point. Where it lost me was the next episode. And I found like the interplay between Linklater and Alex Esso's Mildred Gunning, the older woman who ages back in time. Like there's the reveal that they were lovers that could not consummate it really because he was a priest and she was married and they pined for one another. It's revealed that this whole thing was essentially done because he didn't want to lose her to Alzheimer's, to age. That felt like such a huge cop out to me. I'm like, I was so on board with the idea of like, let's do it for the spiritual reasons. And that's a fascinating subject to discuss. Like, can we use these instruments of evil to spread gospel spirituality if it in the end proves the existence of a higher power? And then it comes down to like, actually, I did it for a chick. That is what kind of, and I'm simplifying it there.
Yeah.
That's where it kind of like, ooh, it's kind of like you tiptoed up to a very dangerous line and then stepped back from it a bit.
Oh, I love that part.
And I also, it didn't bother me. I think it can be both. And I think it was for him and his character and the way that I understood the narrative, which is fictional. You know, but it's, to me, I think he really did have faith, but like, I think that he was so overwhelmed by the experience, which there's some logical issues to me about, like, why didn't that vampire kill more people on the road to Damascus? And why wasn't the whole thing sprouting from there? Or what? But that, putting that aside for a minute, I thought that he, I mean, imagine if you are in the later stages of dementia on death's door, plucked out of that nightmare world of your brain being covered in like plaques and tangles of proteins and thrust into this almost religious clarity of basically being given superpowers. And then the first person that you really spend a lot of time with is Bev Keane, who speaks your language, who I think was the one, as you put in the synopsis, turning his ear toward the more militant Christian stuff. I think that at the end of the day, Father Pruitt really was a well-intentioned man whose heart was full of love, and it was poisoned by a series of really unspeakable experiences that I don't know any of us might be powerful enough to resist. And I think that goes right again back into the themes of substance abuse, of of true spiritual penance, you know, and the things we do to convince ourselves or rationalize that our actions are good. And I think his love for Mildred, or whatever the character's name is, you know, to me, love is love, and that's the essence of faith, right? You know, and so, like, I think he applied that love to this life's greatest regret, but I don't think that it had to undermine all the other stuff he was saying earlier before he went like full crusades on us, you know. So I don't know. I see what you're saying. It just didn't hit me that way. And so it's just so interesting to unpack it, because that's just not how I felt while I was watching it.
I really loved when he sees the fruit of his labor in the last episode and how spoiled that fruit is.
Yes.
The horror, the abject horror and remorse that he feels.
Yes.
And I think it's a really great counterpoint to Bev Keane. I think that is incredible. And also the moment that really gutted me in the last episode was when he reveals himself to his daughter. He says, like, I'm sorry that I never got to know you. I'm sorry you never knew the truth. And like, he reveals his parentage to her, and then that's immediately ripped away from him. That was the moment that really gutted me in this.
And
when she is rejecting the blood also. Yeah. Anyway, go ahead.
And she doesn't want this fantasy that he has concocted for the, their little family. The thing that got me about that is kind of, and it lines up with my own personal views on religion and some things that I'm struggling with, is just like how restrictive I find it sometimes. And I think like the way I read this is what a tragedy it was that he was so afraid of rejection by the church or rejection by his congregation, that he couldn't be with the woman who he loved and who loved him, and that they couldn't have this family. And that is, I think, the larger picture, the way that I kind of access that story, is that it just spoke to me about this, what feels to me, and I don't want to be offensive to anyone, but it feels like an arbitrary kind of rule that I don't know if, you know, like what, like, you can love God and a woman at the same time, you know?
Yeah, Catholic bullshit. So, I'll go ahead and say it. I was tortured for 8 years and called a Jew, a Christ-killing, various other epithets, you know? So I'll say it. It's Catholic bullshit.
Yeah. It 100% is that.
I was like, well, why can't, because if you believe that God will forgive you for anything, God will forgive you for this, you know?
Yeah, God will forgive you for true love and raising a family, which is like, you know, it's such ass backwards bullshit. Yeah. I can't.
What God probably won't forgive you for, though, is killing dogs. And to that, we have Miss Bev Keane.
Okay. And so the thing that I love about Father Pruitt, one, I just want to give a shout out to the actor in the 6th episode when all the shit is going down and you forget that he is still preaching. Like, he's preaching over all of this because it's just the background, and just what a phenomenal performance that was and how much energy that took. And I just fell in love with him. But yeah, the way that he speaks to people, like the part that struck me was when Riley came to church and he was like, I'm not quite a believer right now. And he's like, oh, we can work with that. And just total love for this person who he feels, but also not like, I'm going to make you believe what I believe. It's I'm going to try to understand what you understand, which is completely the opposite of how Bev sees everybody. She is just the, I know so many people like Bev down here.
I bet. She is like the, like, perfect encapsulation of the, like, pleasant on the surface, dead eyes. You know, you fucking know she would, like, kill you if given half a chance. Like, you know, she's bless your heart
personified.
Exactly. Yeah.
The scene in the schoolhouse with when Bev is basically, there's the town meeting because the sheriff who, again, played by, oh God, I can't remember his
name.
Rahul Aburi, who's, you know, is a Muslim. Who's like the Muslim town sheriff. He's the only Muslim in a population of Catholics. And, you know, he's rightfully upset, like saying, hey, we cannot have like this book in our school. Like it's the Bible is doesn't belong here. It's not appropriate. There's separation. And he's able to like logically eviscerate her argument and also speak from a place of great love and respect as a Muslim, saying, no, we love Jesus. We respect Jesus. We find him to be one of the great prophets and one of the closest emissaries of God. And we are fascinated by him, but at the same time, like we wouldn't put our book in your school, even though that's our word of faith. Like we don't believe it belongs in a public school. And how Bev like kind of twists that argument in a way that you've seen done in the way she's so dismissive of Aaron. It hurts to see it. And you know that that argument's going to work, even though it doesn't make any sense. Cause you, I think you see it time and time again in the world we live in right now. Uh-huh. And like
that,
you said,
that scene was so well written.
Yeah.
Just like, just that interplay that
it's like
dance
a masterclass,
in that, and I think like her character is summed up so well by Annie at the end, where she's like,
Annie gets her ass.
Yeah, like God doesn't love you any more than he loves anybody else, and that's what really burns you. This idea that like you feel that you're better or more deserving of God's total love and others are less than, and that's not the case.
And you only want it if somebody else can't have it.
Yes. And I love her fate. I love this idea. Like, you know, when the sheriff is like, just basically bows to the son and accepts what's coming to him. I love that scene with the father and son where one turns the ash and the other just keels over while she is literally trying to dig herself a hole in the ground in that last ditch effort to save herself, even though she believes that she's quote unquote saved and will have eternal salvation. You see just how little that faith really means when the time comes. I found that wonderfully executed.
That I like that's the interplay of like true faith versus your false faith like was just so did you guys see Saint Maud?
Yes.
That whole sequence toward the end was giving me Saint Maud vibes also. I felt like those two characters could go like, you know, drink in a bar, probably have sex with each other, probably then hate each other and then be like, you did this to me, and then they would like murder each other in like a weird religious frenzy. Like anyway, that's just beside the point.
I found the closing shot of Saint Maud one of the funniest bits of unintentional comedy. I know I'm not supposed to feel that, and I thought it was a wonderful movie overall. Like it wasn't a horror movie. Like people, it's the scariest horror movie. I'm like, it's a great drama.
Psychological drama.
It's great, one of those, but I found that last shot, I'm like, oh, that's hysterical. Won't spoil it for anybody. But yeah.
Well, a similar shot that I don't know if that's a spoiler, but the ending of episode 5, and I know we already talked about Riley in the boat, but just the way that plays out is just perfection. Like especially like when he enters, like he opens the door and there's a really sinister look on his face and there's like a chord that plays and you're like, oh shit, he's gonna vamp her. And then just the way like it cuts to, you think he's about to die, and then it's this beautiful moment, and then it cuts back to her like screaming in the boat. It's just perfection.
Wonderfully done. Now that's horror editing. It's like it can be both really emotionally touching and deliver a horror moment at the end of it. Like that is like, mwah, like chef's kiss, you know?
Yeah. One of the key things about the last two episodes I would say, is the removal of free will from the members of the constituency. They're not giving themselves over to the to Father Pruitt and his, you know, and if you haven't seen it, the idea is like they're going to vamp the whole town. They're all led to church. It's Easter Sunday at midnight, and the doors are now locked. And the idea is the congregation that have already been vamped are going to turn the other parishioners into vampires as well. The problem is like no, and the, even before that, Father Pruitt has been spiking the communal wine with vampire blood, which is why persons de-age, why people don't need glasses anymore, why, you know, why like the young woman in a wheelchair is able to walk again. None of that was done with any of their knowledge, which you're kind of removing this idea of free will. And then this idea that we're going to just turn everybody, they're, you know, Father Pruitt takes it on faith that they're going to accept this despite the many protestations. And even after they're turned, you see with like the Flynn family and some others, like this is not what they chose, and they're fighting all of their urges, you know, for their bloodlust. I found that fascinating as well, that like the faith not given freely, but actually like kind of like just taken by force.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like coerced, or like, I mean, drugged, really.
Yeah, they got like roofied into being vampires, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And just what a betrayal that is, you know, even though they get these benefits, or what seem like benefits. Yeah.
That's a double-edged sword. It's a poisoned chalice, you know, literally.
But I think that plays on a lot of themes about religion and cults and, like first one's free, you know, or like, look, this has been, this is a really warm, loving community. We'll help you watch your children. We'll give you a, and then suddenly you've signed on to this thing, or you don't even realize you believe this thing that is not what I see Christianity to be, you know? Yeah.
The other shitty thing about Bev, the fact that she uses like the ecological disaster that has kind of crippled, it cripples the town's economy, and she convinces everybody, hey, take this like settlement, and then convinces them to use that money to build a rec center for the church, which is completely unnecessary. And this idea that like the church has benefited, yet its constituents and its congregation, they're economically devastated. And you, I think it's even hinted at like that used to be like 1,000 people that lived in this small island community, and now you're down to like 127 because there's just, there's no jobs, there's no food. It's a really, I think the difference between this and Salem's Lot, where Salem's Lot is a quaint New England, lovely little town, this is like a town that is literally dying. It is on its absolute last legs, and all by the selfishness.
Right. You selfish, but like righteousness, you know, and that's what convinced them. There's a really great episode of You're Wrong About that talks about the Exxon Valdez spill and how that like decimated the community, which I was glad I had that knowledge in my pocket, because I think that kind of informed a little bit of like what it really means and how that short-term payoff can really, really fuck you down the road, you know? Yeah, she is just the worst. I almost wrote a strong female antagonist blog about it. I think I'm going to save it for Easter.
Sure.
Yeah, that would actually be perfect. Like,
right, yeah, I needed to digest. Yes, I needed to have a little distance from Miss Bev Keen. Also, I could not rewatch this thing again yet. I'm not quite.
Yeah, I need to take a minute. I might rewatch Haunting of Hill House just because it's been now 3 years since I've watched it, and I still think it's such a good October thing to watch. Anyway, I'm really tempted to read this poem.
Do it.
I don't know if you want me to, actually. I don't know. It's just this whole series really made me think of this poem by Philip Larkin called Abad, which is means dawn song. So I thought, like, and it's all about death. I'll just read at least a stanza of it, because it's not short, but it's a little long. So. And it just, this phrase kept popping into my head, and the whole poem is about like the fear of death that you wake up with in the middle of the night, and how dawn doesn't even wash it away, really. But let's see. And only life can take so long to climb, clear of its wrong beginnings, and may never, but at the total emptiness forever, the sure extinction that we travel to, and shall be lost in always, not to be here, not to be anywhere, and soon, nothing more terrible, nothing more true. This is a special way of being afraid, no trick dispels. Religion used to try, that vast, moth-eaten musical brocade, created to pretend we never die. And specious stuff that says no rational being can fear a thing it will not feel. Not seeing that this is what we fear. No sight, no sound, no touch or taste or smell, nothing to think with, nothing to love or link with, the anesthetic from which none come round. Anyway, I can't stop thinking about this poem in relation to this series. It's and Philip Larkin was like the most cynical of the poets, but he had such a beautiful writing. But that phrase, that vast moth-eaten musical brocade created to pretend we never die, just haunts me every day when I think about faith and when I think about religion and how it's actually that to me is the essence of organized religion in this show, is this vast brocade that's got moth holes eaten into it. But when you lift it up, there's not really anything there. So it's about going deeper. And that's like Riley's journey. And this is to find a deeper truth that says, even if we go toward nothing, even if we go toward heaven or hell, I will take the right actions because you have to. And then like Aaron's whole thing, I don't know. It's just something that these things are so hard to talk about it without sounding like a lamoid.
Yeah, they are. And the other thing that really, really touched me was Aaron's monologue about her miscarriage. And that's something that I've experienced. And it's something, it's the kind of thing where like, it's, and I'm speaking for myself only, but like once, like I've had two children now, so it's really easy for me to just not think about that at all. And the reason that I cried so hard in that, because I realized I hadn't thought about that life in I don't know how long, you know, and that just felt like, but it's so hard to like, what do you think about? Because I never, like, we didn't even get far enough along to know if it was a boy or a girl. So like, it's hard to wrap your mind around. And so I just loved the spelling out of what could have happened, you know. And there's another, an orphan, which is a totally different thing, that there's like, she's signing a miscarriage to this child. And just like the way that she, her hands move, it's just this beautiful depiction of what this really hard thing to talk about. And I really appreciated hearing those words. And it like brought me to a time that I feel like I don't know if I acknowledged, because there was just like, as soon as it happened, I just wanted to fix it by getting pregnant again, you know? And so it was like, yeah, but that did mean something. And that was a loss, and that life deserves to be honored too. And I think the thing that I really connected with the show on is this feeling of, we don't always know why things happen, you know? And that was the kind of a turning point for me, is like, I'm not going to ever know if it was like, I just ran too fast one day, or like I ate the wrong thing. Like there is no way I'm ever going to know why what happened. And I just have to be okay with it. And now that I'm okay with it, I was able to move on. And I think seeing her kind of grapple with that, and seeing Riley grapple with why do these things happen, and how can we continue living knowing that these things might happen again, but that we have to keep going. It was beautiful, you know? And that's when I forgive the schmaltziness, because I'm like, sometimes I want to hear words that are like that, you know? It's like at the end of Wonder Woman where she says, I believe in love. And as cheesy as that can be, sometimes you just want to say that, you know?
Yeah. I think there needs to be room in art and in life to be like so sickeningly earnest that it can put people off. I think sometimes you do need that. It's part of the spectrum of human experience. And on some days you just need to be able to do that without any layer of irony, you know?
Yeah. And I wonder if that's where some of the resistance to the show comes from, is that sometimes, because it is hard to bring yourself there, you know? And sometimes I'm like, nope, I don't want to touch these emotions right now. And so I wonder, you know, I mean, it's okay if somebody just didn't like this, but I wonder if that's where some of the opposition comes from. Is like, this is this hitting me too deeply right now?
You know? I mean, He is so raw and so earnest. And I mean, I can see why, you know, there's plenty of days where I'm like, not today, motherfucker. I can't deal with this right now. But like, and it, you know, and it hits part of my brain that goes, ooh, this is cheesy and not like the most sophisticated writing. But then it just hits, it's like music. It hits you on a nonverbal level and it just makes you like, just tears you open, you know? I don't know. And I know that, you know, and this isn't to criticize your take on it, Mike. I know that there some of those monologues aren't your favorite. It's just, I think it's complicated. And
it's
all of
part
this,
of the fabric of the show. I mean, I get it. Like, you're trying to deliver as authentic an experience to Catholic mass as possible. And I think that the monologues, they're critical to the show. I can't fault it for that. I just, at a certain point, I'm just like, oh boy, here we go.
Yeah, maybe one less monologue. Yeah, do that. Maybe take, just cut one of them, you know?
And I agree with that, and I am the registered Flannistan of
Yes. You know, it's like, we kind of like, we get the point now. We kind of get what you're, you know, warriors of God, yada, yada, miracles happen, yada, yada. But no, I think, you know, I think what you and what you're both saying, like, really resonates. Like, I don't disagree, and I can understand, you know, like I said, like the first five episodes had me hooked. And I think if it continued in that tone, it would have really landed for me. As it is, it's a partial land. It's fantastic and probably something at some point I'll revisit. And I think maybe kind of knowing how it plays out, if I'll allow myself maybe to kind of like sit back a little bit from it and see if those last two shows work for me. But I think we've covered it. I think we've kind of nailed it, unless there's any final thoughts.
No, I read a freaking poem. I read a poem. I can't do anything more. I can't. I'm not allowed.
And done.
It was a great poem, too. Will you say the name of it one more time and the author, in case anyone wants to read the whole thing?
Abed by Philip Larkin. That's spelled A-U-B-A-D as in dog, E. It means a song you sing at dawn or to the dawn.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. Well, patrons, we hope you enjoyed our bonus episode on Midnight Mass. This is part of the bonus episode that all of our patrons get. If you want more of our patron content, if you're at the $5 tier, you'll also have access to the medicine chest. And then later this month, you'll have access to the treatment plan where I talk about Dr. Sam Loomis's shortcomings as a psychiatrist. That's at the $10 tier. But we want to say thank you again to anyone who has subscribed to our patron page. It does go a long way to help keeping the show going, cover the costs of doing the show and research materials and just everything else. And it means a lot to us. So thank you so much. And we'll be back with our regular feed. Are we doing we're all out of bubble gum on the patrons? I don't know. Should we?
We're all out of communion.
We're all
out of wafers.
We came here to kick ass for the Lord. And we're all out of communion wafers.
Exactly. I think we should change that to our regular sign.
I know. We came here to kick ass for the Lord.
Excellent. All right. Good night, everybody.
Good night.